I'm Marianne Combs, in for Tom Weber. Coming up later this hour, a conversation with poet Bao Fi about the legacy of inherited trauma and how fatherhood inspired his latest book of poetry, Thousand Star Hotel. But first, the role of satire in our current political divide. Late-night political comedy shows, whether it's The Daily Show, Saturday Night Live, Late Night with Stephen Colbert, or Full Frontal with Samantha Bee, have come under criticism for driving away conservative audiences as they skewer President Donald Trump and his administration. Take, for example, Samantha Bee's response to President Trump's State of the Union address.
Last week, America's one-man white supremacist employment program managed to talk about his dystopian agenda using an indoor voice without mentioning his electoral college win or deporting anyone from Congress. Hooray! For this astonishing feat, the pundits rained golden compliments down on him in the warmest shower he's ever had outside of Moscow.
In his short political career, it's the best speech he's given.
I feel like tonight, Donald Trump became the president.
Not only was he more presidential, he was a politician.
Great reset button for him.
Truly extraordinary moment. That was one of the most extraordinary moments you have ever seen in American politics, period.
What the f*** is wrong with you? Question mark, exclamation point, rage emoji. If pundits set the bar for President Trump any lower, even Jeff Sessions won't be able to walk under it without bumping his head.
That was Samantha Bee on her comedy show Full Frontal. With late-night comedy pushing out a daily digest of Trump bashing and endlessly lampooning his supporters, is political satire widening the cultural divide in this nation? Joining me to discuss the role of comedy in an era of President Trump is Caitlin Flanagan. She wrote the recent piece, How Late-Night Comedy Fueled the Rise of Trump, in the May issue of The Atlantic. She's also the author of Girlland and To Hell With All That. Caitlin Flanagan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by stand-up comedian Raghav Mehta, who writes for the comedy production firm Above Average. Raghav, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
So, Caitlin Flanagan, you wrote in The Atlantic that the smug liberalism of comedians is affecting how people of different politics talk. How so?
Well, you know, it's kind of an openly acknowledged fact that, you know, what we call the mainstream media, which would be publications such as the ones that I write for, you know, and the mainstream news, that those are all pretty much in the hands of the progressive left, by and large, and that talk radio and the internet are pretty much in the hands of the conservative right. And so you have a strange asymmetrical war going on. There's certainly every bit as much of nastiness on the right as there is on the left, but because the left has these powerful outlets, and because you have these political comedy shows that are progressive, that are on ABC, CBS, you know, NBC, all the big channels and many of the big cable channels, it can start to feel as though this whole big machine is against the right. And, you know, the Samantha Bee quotes that you played, I didn't have any problem with those. That's just political satire. But she has a history of really going against just everyday conservatives going about their lives, individual people, mocking them ruthlessly, and in one case apologizing, but that was it. And so there's this idea that it's not just the politicians that it's open season on, but it's even the followers, that even to have voted for Donald Trump means you're beneath contempt and that you can be mocked endlessly. And I think that helped to fuel this disaffection, this tremendous disaffection that helped lead to his ultimate election.
And how so? Because if you say that, you know, the conservative right has the internet and other outlets for and talk shows, then is that really just such an imbalance? How did that lead to the rise of President Trump?
Well, it's two very different worlds. You know, there's something official and large about what we call the mainstream media. And I'm deeply within it. So I'm sort of admitting, like, our own secrets, I guess, that you can read these articles and there's a sense that we're better, we're smarter, we're more educated, and we just think these people who voted this way can't possibly be intelligent at all. And that kind of attitude at the top always fuels populism. Mm-hmm. And then at the bottom, or rather on the other side, but there's some, the people on the left in these forums, they're held in some kind of check because there's still standards and practices of some sort. There's still house style of some sort. There's still the sense that you're not going to completely say the most heinous things. And, of course, there's no standards and practices online and far less on talk radio. So you have one kind of ugliness that's seeding out there on these dark corners of the Internet, and you have another kind of smug liberalism that dominates the legitimate airwaves. And I think it's all brought us to this time that there's a lot of heat and very little light, and there are just a huge number of Americans living in the so-called flyover states, as they're often called, in the, you know, bi-coastal places, that just said, you know, CBS News, all these places that when I grew up, they seemed to be honest brokers. They seemed to be outlets that were made for all Americans. They have contempt for me, and they'll put people on who just loathe me, and I'm going to, you know, I give up playing ball with them. I'm going to create my own world, my own set of outlets, and I think that was a legitimate response, and I think that it's really fueled this very asymmetrical media landscape into which, you know, which is a very fertile ground for comedy, obviously.
Raghav Mehta, as a comedian, what do you see as the role of good political satire?
It's difficult to measure. There's no metric for it. And the other problem is I don't know if satire has ever engineered ideal political outcomes for anyone. You know, say what you will about The Daily Show and Jon Stewart, which I grew up watching. And, you know, it definitely galvanized a generation of voters and made them conscious and engaged. But, you know, the Iraq war still happened. We still reelected George Bush, and now Trump is president. If you talk about the liberal mainstream media machine, I mean, you have to take into account the conservative media apparatus, which is arguably more like talk radio and cable news and the obscenely divisive statements they've made about liberals and leftists for decades. Like, we're talking about a right-wing establishment that has demonized minorities and gay people and immigrants for years, and Republican voters still embrace them. So I'm not sure how divisive liberal comedy is and how it's contributed to that national divide.
This hour, we're talking about the role of political satire and whether it's helping or hurting the current cultural divide of our nation. We're also taking your calls. Do you watch shows like Full Frontal or Late Night with Stephen Colbert? And what do you get out of their political satire? Or do you feel alienated by the liberal slanted comedy? Is it possible for late night comedians to contribute to bringing people of different mindsets together? You can give us a call with your comment or question at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000. Or you can reach us toll free at 1-800-242-2828. That's 1-800-242-2828. Or, of course, you can email us at talk@mprnews.org. Raghav Mehta, that is a really interesting point that, you know, there's as much going on the other side, and we haven't necessarily seen outcomes that you would associate with a vast liberal media powerhouse. Is liberal media perhaps shooting itself in the foot with all of this very slanted comedy and satire?
I don't particularly think so. I think good liberal comedy has a joke in mind. I can speak personally for myself. When I approach comedy, I don't think about it in this sort of utilitarian for the greater good of society angle. I mean, once you start doing that, you start drifting away from comedy and you get into politicking and activism. And if I wanted to do activism, I certainly wouldn't be using a medium as ineffective as comedy. But I think when good satirical comedians are approaching this, they're looking for the joke. And as we know, if you look at the modern political climate, it's pretty easy to find the joke. And a lot of it tends to be on the right side.
Caitlin Flanagan, what do you think of that?
Well, I absolutely agree with him that, you know, that comedy, the role of comedy is, you know, not to bring people together in any political way. It's an art form, you know, and that a good comic is being artistic and finding, you know, things which she or he has legitimate connection finds really funny. But, you know, the examples I gave about Samantha Bee, for example, you know, there was a young man who was at a conservative convention this summer, and he was undergoing treatment for a brain cancer. And they showed his picture and said that he was a Nazi. because he had a very strange haircut, and he was just a guy with stage 4 cancer. And then they interviewed a small boy who was supporting Trump and wanted to start a group called Children for Trump. And then they said that he was a larval Jerry Falwell. This was a 10 or 11-year-old kid who was probably waiting to see himself on TV because he'd been interviewed by a grown-up. And now the Samantha Bee Show has given him the nickname he goes through school with. And, you know, I challenged Samantha Bee. I said, look, let's make this right. Let's start a college fund for this kid. You know, you get started, I'll contribute $1,000. And they haven't responded to that at all. Mm. I think that when you start going for the idea that Trump is so terrible, he is terrible. There's no doubt about it. But when you think that he's so terrible that anybody can be mocked endlessly, including children and sick people, then you've crossed a certain Rubicon, and then you've gotten people to say, you know, we are loathed by the mainstream, and we are going to find our own way. And, you know, they always say, you know, JF Kennedy, the first television president, and then LBJ, the first president to start trying to go over the head of television and to reach his followers directly. You know, they've all tried to do that. Reagan was sort of successful. But Donald Trump is the first one who says, you can communicate to his followers, follow my tweets, follow my weekly addresses, follow things that my surrogates say, and everything in the news is a lie, and everything in the mainstream news is just made to mock you and humiliate you. And I think this kind of, and this isn't just comedy, this is the way the news has been for 50 years, everything about the way the news is structured and the way it's delivered and the people who deliver it was engineered to create a class of people who said, we no longer believe it at all. That's a very dangerous place to be. And it's within that landscape that political comedy exists.
And Caitlin, you make the point in your piece in The Atlantic that Samantha Bee, in essence, is sort of using the same tactics that President Trump is doing while attempting to criticize Trump. She's actually being very similar in her behavior.
Right. And obviously he's the president and she's a comic, so she doesn't have to change, you know, she doesn't have to rise to any level that we would in normal times expect a president to rise to. But this is this president who's emanated out of this world in part that she's emanated out of, which is television that often is lowest common denominator, that is a kind of television where anything goes, a kind of television where the cheap thrill is what's going to get you through to the next episode. So, and most importantly, the thing that unifies his apprentice with, say, Samantha Bee, are these moments of cruelty, you know, absolute cruelty, making a joke about a child, you know, getting his mother to sign a release so you could use that on television, making a joke at the expense of a child, that's cruelty. And the more that we can recognize, those of us on the left, I count myself as a progressive, the more that we can realize that we've allowed this moment to bring out not our better angels, but our own worst impulses, I think, you know, the better we'll be in this sort of 4-year battle we're in.
Mm. Let's go to the phones. We've got Judy on the line in West St. Paul. Judy, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot for taking my call.
Sure thing.
You know, I am a healthcare provider, and I work with kids in inner city. I work with LGBT kids. My husband works with mentally ill. And I'll tell you, after a day of work, when you're trying to figure out places to stay, food to eat for these kids, education, healthcare, jump through the hoops to help them get their medications and stuff, you know, at the end of the day, sometimes I just need to laugh. Mm. Sometimes I need to see the silly side and the extraordinarily odd side of things that are happening sometimes, and I need to laugh. And I think that's a lot of us these days. I think we need to laugh. I keep a joke book at our bed at night, so before we go to bed, we tell jokes. What do we do for fun? We spend our money going to comedy clubs so we can laugh.
Mm-hmm.
You gotta laugh these days, and I'm sorry that it offends people, but the kids I work with, they're offended day in and day out by lots of people who don't understand their stories, and I tell you, it's tough for kids. So I'm sorry that the left and the right are getting bombarded or whatever with all this stuff going on. But you know what? At the end, we're all people. We're more alike than they are different. But please don't take away my shows. You know, I made it to the Bush years. I made it to the Bush years with Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert. And I was going through menopause and I had adolescence. So, you know, we got to laugh. And I'm sorry if it's hurting people, but there are real people here also that are hurting day in and day out that I see.
Okay.
So we got to sometimes remember we all have a sense of humor.
All right, Judy, thanks so much for your call and appreciate that call. But we've got a lot of other callers on the line who'd like to share their thoughts on this. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Craig on the line in Prior Lake. Craig, are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right. Your thoughts.
Yes, and to the last caller, I'm the father of a kid with special needs, so I know and appreciate what people do in that area. I think the late night TV is mean-spirited and unfair. I think, you know, we can all handle some good-natured kidding like Obama got from late night TV, you know, along with a ton of admiration that he got. But stuff against Trump has been overwhelming. And I didn't vote for Trump. I voted for Gary Johnson out of protest to Trump because I think he's a poor spokesman for the things I believe in. On the same token, I think his policies, a lot of them I agree with, and I'd like to see them be successful. But I feel like there's a war being waged against him by the mainstream media. And, CNN had egg on their face. They were surprised. They were, you know, then Trump's, you know, being Trump, you know, treated him poorly. So they're, you know, so they're taking offense to that. So now they're even going heavier on him all the time.
Craig, do you feel alienated by the late night comedy shows? Or is there something that you can dip in and watch? Or do you just feel like I just can't even go there?
Well, I can't even go there anymore. I mean, I used to watch Fallon at least because I thought he was semi-fair, but he's off the
Jimmy
deep
Fallon,
end.
Jimmy Fallon, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, it's like when I go to a concert at First Avenue and I see Steve Earle, who is one of my favorite artists, he is a very liberal guy, and his songs say everything I need to hear. He doesn't need to preach at me in between songs, and I feel exactly the same way about these people.
Okay.
They're just over-the-top cruel.
Gotcha. Craig, thank you so much for your call. Really appreciate it. Raghav Mehta, what do you think of Craig's response that this is just too cruel, that we shouldn't be, you know, lambasting the president this way?
Well, to go back, incorporating his point and Caitlin's point, if we remember from the election, I mean, Trump mocked a disabled reporter. I mean, it's weird that we're holding comedians to this almost higher standard than we are our politicians. And I know we addressed this earlier, but I think there is this myth about how late night is especially cruel towards conservatives when during the election, Trump appeared on Fallon and had a pretty good-natured conversation with him. He appeared on Colbert and had a pretty good-natured conversation with him. I think, by and large, this idea that liberals are uniquely cruel towards conservatives, whether it's in late night comedy or in the media, is a lot of myth-making involved there.
Caitlin, you wrote a bit about this incident in which Trump was interviewed on Jimmy Fallon's show, and how Jimmy Fallon was later really taken to task for "quote unquote" humanizing President Trump.
Yeah, I'll speak to that. But first, I just have to say about your two callers, you know, I'm married to a Minnesotan, and I love Minnesota. I mean, I live my life in the blue media, the blue bi-coastal bubble. And when Judy said, "I'm sorry," but, and then she gave her response, and Craig said, "I just think it's mean-spirited and unfair." I just think if the country was always run by a Minnesotan, we'd always be in good shape. And as far as Judy going through menopause during the Bush years, my heart is out to her. I mean, at least I had those two events at, you know, not at the same time. My God, that she kept it together during that is laudable. Well, I think what's going on, again, as I keep saying, is that, you know, we, the progressive left, and include anybody we want to in that, you know, I've worked in this world a long time now. I've written for many, many and been on many, you know, shows. And we are all of a mindset. We try our level best. I mean, I'm a commentator, so I don't have to try to appear unbiased. But, you know, when we're together at the dinner party, we who make up, you know, the mainstream media, we are really of a mind. And it's very hard not to let these attitudes, these opinions, these beliefs, these cultural sort of associations come through in the way we see the world and in the way we talk about the world on air. It's very hard not to do that. And because of that, there's been this driving away of conservatives, and what the alternate world, the parallel world, is much darker. As far as Jimmy Fallon, yeah, he, you know, had Trump on, and they had a little bit that they'd planned out that he could, you know, tousle his hair. And it was the kind of thing that we kind of associate with presidential candidates. We think of, you know, long ago, Bill Clinton playing the sax on the Arsenio
right.
Hall show, this kind of stunt that you do along the way. And so it wasn't out of line at all for a presidential candidate to be on a late-night talk show and do some goofy thing like that. You know, later on when he was running to be reelected, Bill Clinton went on MTV, and they asked him if he wore boxers and briefs, and without hesitation he said briefs, and he was hailed by the young people for not being a prude about answering it. So it wasn't a weird thing, but people were, you know, on the progressive left were rightly, I think, so concerned about Donald Trump and what he might represent that they thought that this moment of making him seem like just another guy, you know, an outer borough guy that had his own shtick and his own kind of New York accent and tousling his hair, that this was just a terrible thing for Fallon to have done. And Fallon's ratings really took a dive and, in a way, haven't really recovered from that moment.
Mm-hmm. You know, we've got a lot of callers on the line. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Neil on the line in St. Peter. Neil, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi there. What's your comment or question?
Well, I was listening to the comment about Fallon being demonized for humanizing Trump. That's ridiculous. I mean, the whole context with the whole political climate now is the other side of the enemy. It's just, I don't know. The whole late-night thing with Samantha Bee, you see it on the commercials, and it's just so polarizing. I think it's too much.
Mm-hmm. Neil, where do you go for your comedy or satire?
I really don't, to
yeah.
be honest. I don't watch a lot of TVs. TV's mainly on when my kids are watching it,
mm-hmm.
and I don't like them watching that. I don't like them seeing those commercials that are all about insults.
Yeah. All right, Neil, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it. Let's go to John in St. Paul. John, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
We were talking about busting myths, and I really... While I understand that many professional journalists might be what you just described as the progressive left, they work for organizations that are not. Most of the media in this country is controlled by large Fortune 500 corporations. And whereas the ground-level folks may have left-wing political views, their editors and their owners do not. And I really, really think that saying that there is a powerful left-wing media is not true. There are some who have decided that they can make money, and there's an understanding that there's a left-wing market. But when you compare Fox News, which was set up by, you know, Reagan political operatives to be a right-wing propaganda station explicitly, and comparing it with somebody who's got a left-wing comic, I don't think that that's comparable.
Mm. Thanks, John. Caitlin, what do you say to that? We have a media industry that's, you know, owned and run by more conservative-leaning people. So, how does that fit with your argument that it's the, you know, it's the left wing, you know, it's an agent of the left wing agenda?
I've never ever had written anything where I felt that some owner was coming down in any way to shape an argument. I've never sensed that. I would have to say that. That they are honest brokers in that way as far as letting the news outlets do their own thing. Fox is a complete anomaly. But the problem with Fox is that, you know, that the tight control of the progressive left on the news media is how you create things like Fox and how you create things like this online stuff, is that people sort of saying, well, we're tired of this. We're going to make our own world, and that's the only one that we're going to watch. And then you have, you know, it's not in a competitive news environment at all, and some of the things they're saying are so clearly partisan and so explicitly partisan. So it's two worlds, two parallel worlds that created one another. And I think, you know, he's right that some outlets are owned within a massive corporation, but I've never sensed that. But I will certainly say that, you know, when I go to events or you know, cocktail parties, these sorts of things with, you know, people who work at these outlets, I always feel, oh, it's a very comfortable feeling for me because we all probably have very similar political opinions, similar opinions about the news, and we want to talk to one another about it. So I don't ever feel that, oh, about half of us are conservative Republicans and about half of us are progressive Democrats or anything in between. I feel that just about everybody is either truly agnostic or on the left, or you've got these people who are hired specifically because everybody has to have a couple of conservative columnists. Mm-hmm. But I've never – have you at NPR felt that? Do you feel that there are as many sort of Republicans or conservatives in your milieu as there are Democrats?
In within the building, you mean?
Like just within the world of NPR, you know, when you're, I don't know, talking with people or, I don't know, colleagues and such.
That's a good question. I would have to take a long moment to do a survey on that. And I would say that we definitely have a range of political viewpoints in here, mm-hmm. Which I think is actually a really good thing. But
yeah.
Yes, I'd say, you know, when you talk about the definition of liberal as a wide sort of viewpoint, a wide ranging viewpoint. And I think in that sense, we are a liberal media outlet. But back to the matter at hand, in talking, Raghav Mehta, we were talking about comedy. And is it too much to ask comedy to be an agent for perhaps bridging a cultural divide? I'm thinking in particular of an SNL skit that was done a while back. It was a black comedy game show, and they had Tom Hanks on as the one white contestant in this game show. And he was, you know, from sort of conservative, poor, some more southern kind of guy. And throughout the game show, they start realizing how much they have in common. And by the end of the show, but, you know, of course, the show takes a sharp turn when they start and they bring up Black Lives Matter. And Tom Hanks says, I have something I'd like to say about that. And they say, oh, time for a commercial break. And they go off to it. But it was really, it was a skit that was well done. It was funny, but it actually underscored the differences across the political divide.
Sure. I think it is asking or expecting too much. I think shows like particularly John Oliver maybe does a good job at focusing on very specific issues and devoting energy to that rather than broad, I don't know, maybe platitudes. But as far as comedy being like an agent of change or a unifier, I just think, like, I think about, if you think about a working class person in North Dakota who just lost his job at like an oil field, he's not worried about what John Oliver being mean to Sean Spicer on HBO on Sunday. And, you know, he's worried about making a living wage and politicians introducing policies that will, you know, benefit him in the long run. And I want to go back to what John mentioned, the caller previously. I think he makes a really good point about the supposed myth of the liberal media. I mean, you look at the New York Times, who has been the target of so much derision by conservatives, yet they have conservative columnists all the time. You have Bret Stephens, you have various climate change deniers, and these people aren't honest brokers. They're not making reasoned arguments. They're living in fantasy. And you're not going to see the Federalist running an article about climate change. That's just not going to happen. And if you even look at The Atlantic, one of the senior editors is David Frum, who is a former Bush speechwriter.
Caitlin Flanagan, what do you think in terms of the role of comedy as possibly being a place to bring people together rather than divide them? Is that too much to ask for?
Well, I mean, comedy, great comedy, historically has made a lot of change. You know, you think of Lenny Bruce, you know, you think of Richard Pryor. There were great comics who got the country to confront really difficult issues in ways that no one else was able to. And, you know, that's how, you know, Cosby finally was held to account, because a comic made a joke, made a remark about that. So I think it's a really important art form. I, you know, like Judy, I love the shows. I don't watch Samantha Bee. I'll use the word that always gets used against women, myself included. I do think she's the shrill word. But, you know, I watch the shows and I enjoy the shows and I love comedy, and I would never want a comic censored in any way at all. I just do think that when we sort of sit around and say, how could they vote for Trump? How could they be so ignorant? How could they be so this, that, and the other? Well, when they turn on the television to the big flagship networks night after night after night, and the things in their lives and their way of thinking about things is so mocked that even children can be mocked, you know, that there is a consequence for that, and that we've gotten a long way away from even the pretense that these is, that these networks are nonpartisan sort of entities, and that there were certain rules of fairness that had to govern the public airwaves and all that stuff that we remember from, you know, 30 or 40 years ago. And I think it's the more that we can't see the humanity in one another, the more that we can't see, well, maybe someone who voted for Trump isn't a racist, and maybe they're not anti-gay. Maybe they just have kids who are growing up in a place where there is no hope, there is no college, there is no job. Hillary Clinton was offering zero, less than zero, to the kid who's growing up in rural Ohio and has nothing. And maybe that was what was driving them to vote as well, instead of, or not always, because of a incredibly repressive religious or racist agenda. And I think the asymmetrical comedy landscape lent that sense that they were nobodies and they didn't have to be taken into account and they were fools, and they all rose up and showed us a thing or two.
Mm-hmm. Raghav Mehta, we have just a minute left here, but any final thoughts on this issue in terms of the role of political satire and expanding the cultural divide?
I think if people are relying on political satire to bridge the cultural divide, we're in more trouble than we thought. But I do enjoy political satire, and I don't think people are being unnecessarily cruel. I think a lot of minority groups feel targeted by a very fear-mongering conservative media apparatus, and it's a proportionate response.
Mm-hmm. Raghav Mehta, thank you so much for this conversation. One last comment from Marty and Albert Lee writes, I'm so sorry to hear everyone is forced to watch late night TV. You don't have to. So
We don't?
Yes, there you go. Another wise listener here in Minnesota. Thanks so much to both of you for this conversation. It truly has been fascinating. Thank you, Raghav Mehta. Really appreciate you joining this hour.
Thank you.
Raghav Mehta is a stand-up comedian and writer for Above Average. And Caitlin Flanagan, thanks so much to you for your participation today.
You bet. It was fun.
And Caitlin Flanagan is a correspondent for The Atlantic and the author of Girl Land.
Looking for a new podcast? I'm Tracy Mumford, a producer for NPR News. I'm part of the team working on 74 Seconds. It's a new podcast that looks at the shooting death of Philando Castile by Officer Geronimo Yanez. It happened last summer in Falcon Heights, Minnesota. Yanez is now facing charges in Castile's death. 74 Seconds looks at what happened that night and what happens now when a police officer goes on trial. Reporters John Collins and Reham Fashir will walk you through this case as it unfolds. It's a story about race, policing, and justice in America. Subscribe to 74 Seconds wherever you get your podcasts.